So I started work. I'm a pedologist by training, really. I'm not a mineralogist. I'm not a soil fertility person. I'm a pedologist. And I got involved with potassium research maybe 10 or 12 years ago as an outgrowth of a collaboration with soil fertility colleagues of mine at UC Davis, one of whom is Stu Pettigrove in Cooperative Extension. And also co-author on this paper is Gordon Reese. He's in the audience here. Working on potassium, the magic of potassium. I like Michael's, what would you call it? The mystery, the beautiful mystery. Yes. Well, I can't say I agree any less with your concept than of the beautiful mystery. But just a little bit of a background. I have a number of collaborators over the 10 or 12 years that I've been working on soil mineralogy and potassium. The upper group are our colleagues at UC Davis, mineralogists, graduate students, geologists who have helped me with the work I'm reporting on. Then a whole bunch of giants in the middle there. These are the field people, the field mice, the cooperative extension specialists that have helped us identify collaborators in the field with whom we could work and on whose land we could dig holes in the ground to get soil samples. And then funding agencies, Lodi Wine Grape District. I'll talk about potassium in grapes. I'll talk about potassium in cotton. And then funding by California Department of Food and Ag. And IPNI has also helped with this research. Kind of how we got started, it reminded me of Dr. Singh's talk about cotton in Australia. This is how we got involved with potassium in the first place. A bunch of cotton growers in the southern San Joaquin Valley, just over the grapevine from where we are now, started to notice in the 90s and late 90s that they were beginning to show symptoms in their cotton fields of potassium deficiency. And, you know, then the discussion was, is it drainage? Is it verticillium wilt? Is it phloem blockage because of something that we don't understand? And I said, well, you know, I don't know much about cotton. I don't know much about potassium fixation, but as a pedologist, I'm really interested to hear the story that part of the valley may have shown potassium deficiency in cotton and part of the valley didn't. And I said, aha, there must be a soil difference. That's where a pedologist comes in. That's how I got involved. So the first part of our work that I'll talk about has to do with cotton and how we basically cut our teeth on learning about soil mineralogy and potassium fixation in cotton fields. A little bit of a background. To make sure that I can't find my pointer. Oh, there it is. Okay. Here's California. We're down here in Long Beach, just over the grapevine in the southern San Joaquin Valley. Our three counties where a lot of cotton is grown, about 1.2 million acres of cotton grown in California now. It's come and gone as almond prices have varied, interestingly. As almond prices go up, acreage of cotton goes down. Kings, Kern, and Fresno County are big seats of cotton production. And we got interested, as I say, because of the spatial distribution of potassium deficiencies. And so, if I can get my pointer back, here it is, okay. This side of the valley here, not shown, but is our mountains of the Coast Range. The Coast Range is on this side, and the sediments of the Coast Range are mostly feldspars. They're marine sediments, not a lot of mica. Feldspar and quartz dominate. On this side of the valley is the Sierra Nevada, which in this part of the Sierra Nevada is dominated by granitic lithology. So feldspar, quartz, and biotite and hornblende are the main constituents. And so we sampled soils on this side of the valley, which were formed, these soils up here mostly formed from Coast Range alluvium, recognizing that mineralogy may play a role. And these soils on the east side formed mostly formed from granitic alluvium. Because we thought, our hypothesis was granitic alluvium would give rise to biotite, which would give rise to vermiculite, which would give rise to K-fixation. So we sampled soils on both sides of the valley to capture that variation. You've heard about sodium tetraphenyl boron extraction, plant available K. I won't talk about the details there. We did employ that method. Ammonium acetate, the most common soil test extractant. We employed that method. But we thought that maybe K fixation was starting to play a role in determining the availability of K for cotton and the resulting symptoms of deficiency. So we developed in our lab of method. Masha Marashkina did her PhD with me back in the early 2000s, and we developed a K fixation method that adds potassium, a known amount of potassium, to a 1 to 10 soil solution mixture. We shake for an hour, and then we try to get that potassium back out by adding concentrated ammonium chloride to try to exchange the potassium back out. Then we measure the amount of K that's left in solution, and the difference between what we added and what we extracted we called K-fix. So we developed this one-hour method to try to assess how much K that was being added to the soil was not being extracted by ammonium. Ken Kassman at UC Davis and some of his graduate students back in the 90s, early 90s, had started to work on this potassium fixation problem, and they developed a seven-day incubation method. And we thought, well, that's great, but if we're trying to get from the lab to the field mouse part, we wanted to have something that maybe we could ultimately develop for test labs that they could do in a fairly short amount of time. And that seven-day incubation, we thought, well, that may be a little bit too long. So we compared our results with those of Kassman, and we found a pretty strong relationship between a one-hour incubation and the seven-day incubation. And that developed our confidence to say, well, we're going to use the one-hour K-fix method as an index of how much potassium that's added to the soil could be fixed against uptake by the plants. So the results show, and I'm summarizing a lot of data here. It's not experimental method approach, but I'm just showing you the summary data here of the amount of potassium in various pools. Okay, so the pools are ammonium acetate extractable K, which is on the left on that x-axis. And then we have two different groups of soils. The Sierra Nevada soils are in black, and the Hatchard are the Coast Range soils. One of the things we noticed on the lower left is in terms of ammonium acetate extractable K, not a lot of difference between the two groups of soils in terms of the amount of nominally exchangeable K. When we ran our one-hour K-fix method on the soils, the Sierra Nevada soils fixed much, much more K than those in the Coast Range alluvium. This is consistent with our hypothesis that the Sierra Nevada soils formed from granite will have biotite and vermiculite in them. They will fix K. Those from the Coast Range don't have biotite and vermiculite. They won't fix K, and our results support that hypothesis. The tetraphenylboron K, much, much more tetraphenylboron K in the Coast Range soils, and we attribute, and the PANK, the plant available non-exchangeable K on the right, is the difference between the TPBK and the ammonium acetate extractable K. And to go back to what Don Spark was talking about, the only way we can really explain the total amount of K available in the Coast Range soils is that it must be extracting potassium from feldspars in those soils. And it's also possible that it's extracting potassium from muscovite mica rather than biotite mica. So we haven't figured out all the details, the mineralogical underpinnings there, but the two main take-home points are that there are big sources of K that apparently are not from, that are not from micas here in the Coast Range, and that the Sierra Nevada soils fix a lot more K than the Coast Range soils. So from a spatial distribution, we were starting to understand, we think, why would certain soils show K deficiency, those from Sierra Nevada side, K deficiency, those from the Coast Range side, no K deficiency. So the question is, what's fixing the K? I'm going to show a different version of the cartoon you've seen before, that Don showed, that Michael showed, that we're all familiar with. The idea is that these micas, in particular biotite, because it's trioctahedral with magnesium and iron in the octahedral sheet, form preferentially expanded planes into which hydrated cations can go and replace the non-hydrated potassium. And so we get this range of degree of decomposition of micas into hydroxy interlayered or hydrobiotite, and then ultimately into vermiculite. So that's what the cartoon looks like. What we tried to do is understand a little bit more about what does the mineral look like. And Don talked about how one can proxy cesium for potassium. and understanding how it's stored by minerals. My colleague Peter Schiffman and I developed a method where we use cesium chloride to stain thin sections of soils. And we would run microprobe analyses of the soils before and after cesium exchange. And so the results that I'm going to show you right now are going to compare on a couple of these transects from a thin section of soil that contains biotite what the composition on a transect from point A to B looks like and what C to D looks like. I'll tell you that I'm not going to show you data from E and F. So we microprobe the samples to understand what the chemical composition is. We stain with cesium and run the analyses again. So on that AB transect, before we exchange with cesium, there's some potassium in the interlayer, there's some calcium in the interlayer, some magnesium possibly in the interlayer and in the exchange sites. When we exchange, but no cesium because we anticipate that there's no cesium floating around in the environment for the most part. And after exchange on that transect B, notice that most of the potassium and calcium in the interlayer has been exchanged by cesium. Making some assumptions about the microprobe analyses, we can calculate a formula of the mineral in that AB transect. And so here's a nice example of a tetrahedrally substituted and octahedrally substituted mica. It's dominantly trioctahedral, but there is some aluminum in the octahedral sheet as well. So this is an alteration product of biotite to vermiculite. Dominantly still trioctahedral like the biotite would have been in its initial stage. So we conclude that in the alteration of biotite, we can produce a compound that we would nominally call vermiculite. And to those nomenclaturists who don't like vermiculite and smectite, I apologize, but I'll call it vermiculite. Transect C and D. It's more electron dense, indicating to us that there's a higher atomic number there and suggesting that it's probably not as highly weathered biotite. And when we do that transect, we see that there's relatively less cesium in the interlayer than in the previous slide. There's less aluminum in the octahedral sheet, more of a remnant of that original trioctahedral formula of a biotite. And so we conclude that that part of the thin section is less altered biotite, more like the original precursor. And from other samples, we analyze fresh biotite, and we find that with fresh biotite, essentially no cesium is exchanged, very, very low cation exchange capacity. And that would represent then this whole suite of that cartoon of alteration of biotite you can find in a thin section in soil, which we presume would translate into various sand fractions in a soil. So the question is, where is the vermiculite? Five different soils sampled now on Sierra alluvium, those that fix K, so we're ignoring at this point the Coast Range alluvium. And we've talked a lot about clay mineralogy today, and what's the seat of potassium fixation in the soils. And at first we thought it would be in the clay fraction as well, but we were surprised, and I'll show you the data that led to our surprise. So these are the soils that we sampled, and some mineralogical details. The names are not particularly important. There's a soil called Kimberlina. This is what the silt fraction looks like. We isolated the silt fraction and x-rayed it, and this peak here at 1.4 nanometers with magnesium saturation is characteristic of vermiculite. It did not expand with magnesium and glycerol treatment. And when we added potassium with our K fixation method, as is a common treatment, we noticed that the 1.4 nanometer peak disappears and collapses to 1 nanometer. So that's consistent with recognition of vermiculite in the silt fraction. Okay, so this is a standard X-ray method. Conclusion, Kimberlina has vermiculite in the silt fraction. Not only does it have vermiculite in the silt fraction, it has vermiculite in the very fine sand fraction. There's that 1.4 nanometer peak that collapses. It has it in the fine sand fraction. A little bit here collapses down. And consistently with all of those five soils, we see this same pattern. Vermiculite in the silt, very fine, even up in the fine sand fraction. The question is, what's in the clay fraction? So here's what clay looks like from a couple of representative soils. Here's the Armona soil and the Kimberlina soil, which we've looked at with magnesium treatment, about 1.4 nanometers. But when we glycerol solvate, that stuff expands. So this is, we conclude that this is a smectite, not a vermiculite in that clay fraction. And then similarly for the Kimberlina, although I know according to Dr. Singh, smectites don't exist, but operationally that's what we call it. It's a smectite. And in the Kimberlina at the bottom, we also see the similar pattern. The take-home message here is not much vermiculite in the clay fraction, but a lot of vermiculite in the silt and very fine sand fraction. That's where the K fixation is occurring, not in the clay fraction. When we summarize K fixation by the various fractions for those five soils formed from Sierra Nevada alluvium, we find that indeed, a negative value for K fixation over here means that K was released from the clay fraction. So we isolated clay, silt, very fine sand, and fine sand fractions, and did that K fix test on those. The clays released K. They did not fix K. But all of these other coarse fractions in all of the soils, the silt, very fine sand, and fine sands were where K fixation occurred, not in the clays. Which I don't think is surprising, given the fact that the weathering product of biotite to vermiculite is quite common in those fractions. So our take-home message there, K fixation caused by vermiculite, but it's in the coarse fraction. It's not in the clay fraction in the soils that we studied. Now we wanted to say, well, okay, that's great for cotton. Can we take what we learned about and go to some other environments? And we got funding then from the grape growers in the Lodi Wine District, which is just south of Sacramento, up in the San Joaquin and Sacramento, where those two valleys come together. We developed then a soil taxonomy, soil survey-driven model that said, okay, based on what we learned about K fixation from the soils in the San Joaquin Valley, can we take that information and try to build a model that would predict where soils in the Lodi Grape District would, where they would fix K and where they wouldn't? So based on soil survey information from what's available online and in published form, we made some assumptions based on the soil texture, the parent material, whether they contained vermiculite or biotite, and the intensity of weathering. The idea being that mica in its unweathered form won't fix K. Mica, once it's weathered to vermiculite, will fix K. And if that mica has weathered past vermiculites to smectite or kaolinite, it won't fix K. So we have this sort of optimum of weathering that gives rise to the ability to have vermiculite in the soil and to fix K. So this is what our GIS model looks like. We have five regions that predict, based on these combinations of soil properties, whether the soils will fix K or not. Very briefly, region one, clayey soils rich in smectite. The idea, not much vermiculite, we figured they wouldn't fix much K. Region two comes from relatively unweathered soils, weakly weathered soils, but from two different kinds of rocks. There's region A from granitic rocks, region B from metamorphic rocks that would not contain biotite. Region three, well-developed soils from granitic rocks. Region 4, highly weathered soils on old terraces, and Region 5 from volcanic rocks. So the idea was we wanted to, within the district, go from lab to field mice to be able to tell the grape growers, will you need to add K to your vineyards or not? We wanted something practical. So our model said Region 1, we anticipated that we would have high exchangeable K because there's smectite and plenty of potassium feldspars, but not much vermiculite, so low K fixation potential. Soil region 2, A and B, these are from the granitic soils, low exchangeable K, but moderate fixation capacity. Figure 2B, region 2B, moderate exchangeable K because of the, I keep losing my mouse up here, there we go, because of the feldspars in the metamorphic rocks, but not vermiculite, so we wouldn't expect much K. Low exchangeable K in region 3 because of weathering to vermiculite with high exchange or potassium fixation. Region 4, this is the model that it would be moderate exchangeable K, probably because of kaolinite in the sand fraction and no K fixation. But it turned out to be a nightmare. I'm just going to tell you it's 2 days after Halloween, and the nightmare continues from soil region 4. And soil region 5 formed from volcanic materials, high exchangeable K because of the potassium feldspars in the volcanic rock, low fixation capacity because there's no biotite, there's no vermiculite. Vermiculite is the key. Okay, so that's the model. That's what we said. Okay, here's what soil survey would tell us, and we'll just be able to translate this into a nice map for the Lodi wine growers. And that's when the truth sank in. And so regions 2A, B, and 4 did not work very well. And I'm not going to show you the data because it would take me all afternoon to explain it. So I'm just going to tell you, the model didn't work because we didn't understand the distribution of the soils in those regions, and the way the soils were mapped did not capture the range of soil properties. So the soil stratigraphy and the soil map unit variability in those regions were not captured in our K-fix prediction model. But I will say, in soil region 1, remember this is fine textured alluvium smectites, our model said, well, smectites should have quite a bit of exchangeable K, but they shouldn't fix much K. And so that's what our model said. And here's exchangeable K shown as XK with depth. So high, it worked for the surface horizon. There's 310 parts per million. So that would be, from a soil test point of view, you'd say, well, you probably don't need to add K. I think we use about 200 parts per million as a soil recommendation in California. The lower horizons have low exchangeable K. Violated our model already. And when we look at the K fixation, we expected no K fixation. And when we looked at the surface horizon, we said, great, right on the money. But when we look at the lower horizon, it fixes K like crazy. Okay. So what we learned, though, from this is that soil region 1 is actually on young alluvial fans. And there's a lot of interstratified materials and old buried surfaces out there. And we can't really predict what the mineralogy is like from the map unit. Okay, so we learned a harsh, hard lesson about the ability to extrapolate the soil survey information to predict K. So I would say, it worked well in the clayey smectitic horizons, but it was complicated by stratigraphy. So I'd say we have some more work to do with our predictive model in that soil region. I'm ignoring 2A and 2B, so don't ask where are those data, because we have a lot of learning to do. I think that's consistent with what a lot of my colleagues have said. Here's soil region 3. This is intermediately weathered landscape. So remember that cartoon, mica, biotite, not much K fixation, right? Not much cation exchange capacity, can't get the K in, can't get the K out. You weather that biotite to a vermiculite, and all that inner layer space is exchangeable. You can put hydrated cations in, hydrated cations out, so you may expect some exchangeable K, but when you put K in there, you can fix that K back. And so we expected low exchangeable K, high K fixation. And, this is what keeps people working, is that they don't always get negative results. So when you look at exchangeable K in these soils, at least the representative soil, our model worked pretty well. The predicted K, in terms of exchangeable K, is quite low, less than 200 parts per million. And we would say, we anticipate you would get a crop response based on a soil fertility test if you added K, because it's less than 200 parts per million. But the question is, well, if you add that K, a lot of it's going to be fixed, and you may not get a crop response anyway, right? So our model works pretty well in telling the farmer, look, if you add K based on soil tests, you may not get a response because K is going to be fixed. Right? Now, one of the things that we haven't done the two C words, the correlation and calibration yet, and that's what's really missing from our work, is to understand how the K predictions or the K fixation numbers translate into what kinds of plant growth is involved. Gordon Reese has a poster later on this week, which I will unashamedly advertise in just a second here. And I'd like you to go see his poster, because we are trying to go from the lab to the field mice part. So the model worked okay in soil region 3. I'm not showing you soil region 4 because that was a disaster. Soil region 3, to show you also why it works, the clay fraction, is dominated by maybe a little bit of mica, but the real take-home message, once again, as we saw in previous work with the cotton, the silt fraction is full of vermiculite. And in the sand fraction under light microscope, here's what the vermiculite looks like. It's the brown stuff that's the alteration product from the mica. And that's in the near surface horizon, 12 to 30 centimeters, and at depth, really not much vermiculite here, but quite a bit of vermiculite in the very fine sand fraction. So that's the seat of K fixation as well. Model works okay. Soil region 4, I'm not going to show you because it was a disaster. Soil region 5 was from volcanic materials that contained no biotite in the parent material. We expected high extractable K because of the potassium feldspars. There it is, plenty of K, and you would never tell the grape farmers to put K on their soils because there's plenty of K. And they didn't fix K because there's no vermiculite. So it's consistent with our findings, at least in the cotton soils. It's vermiculite that is the source of K fixation. And where is the vermiculite? It's mostly in the silt fractions. In soil region 5, you'll notice that most of these clays, these are smectite clays, not vermiculite clays. They expand with glycerol, consistent with the data that Mike Thompson showed. And much of the soil, there's a little bit of biotite in there, but for the most part, very little biotite to fix K. So at that point of view, the model works okay. In summary, vermiculite fixes K. You know, I guess we've known that for 150 years and we're just substantiating that. In our case, what was most interesting is that the vermiculite, the seat of K fixation, is in the silt and fine sand fractions, not in the clay fraction. At the Central Valley scale, east side of the Central Valley versus west side, Coast Range versus Sierra Nevada alluvium, it's quite predictable. We can predict that K will be fixed from Sierra alluvium, will not be fixed from Coast Range alluvium. And that our understanding of K fixation is more complicated at the map unit or landscape scale, as we learned from our work in the Lodi wine grape district, because it's difficult to predict that temporal, that spatial variation of soils on the landscape and how that reflects then in the mineralogy. Our work underway is to go from the lab mouse to the field mouse. We're trying to understand a bit more about K fixation mechanisms, understand the effect of sample handling. We heard a couple of great talks about air dry versus field moist samples and the difference that that gives you in terms of K test results. We're finding the same thing. Also affects our K fixation results. So we're trying to sort that out. And we're also trying to understand that relationship between our K fix value and what plants take up. We haven't gotten to that point. In other words, our K fixation number is really not very meaningful from a soil test point of view yet, but that's what we have to look forward to. Here's my plug, Gordon Reese's poster, Wednesday. It's up there now. Go look at it so you have a bunch of good questions for him on Wednesday from 10 to 12. And thanks.